Right, just following on from our conversation with Kilmacrennan's Vicky. Greg, could you say a big congrats to Vicky and well done to all her teammates from Olivia and McGregor? No problem. Great to hear Amber Barrett on, and congratulations to her. Great ambassador for Donegal. She is a really great ambassador for Donegal. Right, so we've been flagging this to you for a couple of days. The state is facing a legal case over its decision to compel telecommunication providers to retain the data of all citizens due to, in inverted commas, security concerns. Justice Minister Helen McEntee obtained a High Court order requiring telecommunication service providers, that's your Three and your Vodafones, etc., to retain data, including user traffic and location data, for 12 months, this to safeguard the security of the state. Now, she was able to secure this order because she was satisfied there existed a serious and genuine present or foreseeable threat to security of the state. It was held in private. There was no representation from any other concerned groups. It was in camera. We know nothing about it other than its outcome. TJ McIntyre is Chair of Digital Rights Ireland. He joins us now. Good morning, TJ. Thanks for your time today. Where are your... I mean, firstly, what... To give us, actually, to explain it to us, what actually has... what powers has the Justice Minister been granted through this order?
So basically, the telecoms companies have to store details of every text message you send, every call you make, i.e. where you were when you made the call, where you were when you sent the text, to whom you sent it, when it was sent, and so on, every time you logged on or logged off to the internet. And they have to store that for 1 year. And then Gardaí and the Defence Forces can have access to that.
And why would you... Or I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of Helen McEntee, of course, but... This is for all of our security. We're facing threats. I mean, should we not be at least given that information for such a strong order?
Well, I'd agree with you. In fact, I'd go further. So for this order to be legal as a matter of European law, it has to be in relation to some specific identifiable threat and has to be time limited. You can't have these things indefinitely. Instead, what's happened is we've had this adopted on the basis of we don't know what. To continue for a year, and the suspicion has to be at the end of the year they'll come back to the High Court and they will get a rubber stamp of the same order to continue for the following years, just putting this indefinitely into the future. And you know, we've seen this before with the Offences Against the State Act, with the Special Criminal Court, all of these measures which were supposed to be temporary at the outset and have ended up being essentially permanent.
Yeah, and also, like, would we not need more information as to what they're going to do with it? You know, is it for general guard operations? Is it to complement? To complement maybe access to CCTV data into the future? Like, it really is of a significance that, you know, maybe we need another one of these Oireachtas committees to try and tease this out.
That's a very good point. So in theory, this is for national security purposes only. In other words, it can't be accessed for general criminal investigations. Now, there is a big grey area there as to what we mean by national security. We've heard state sources before now tell us that they view, for example, serious organised crime as potentially a threat to state security in some cases. Maybe this is something that could be used in relation to ordinary crime where maybe there's a link to dissident Republican groups. We don't know.
You see, what confuses me is this, the timing is quite interesting following on from the Graham Dwyer case, but presumably that case would not necessarily be classed as a threat to the state. Do you know what I mean? So I'd be interested in the relationship between this move, the findings in the Dwyer appeal, and as to what is going to happen going forward. That is an absence of information that's unacceptable in my view.
That's a really good point. So in theory, and if you take the assurances of the Minister for Justice, this shouldn't be available in any normal criminal investigation, including, for example, the Graham Dwyer case. And one of the reasons why, as you know, the Graham Dwyer appeal is currently underway, he's appealing against his conviction, is because of this legal uncertainty, because this law was adopted in the past to allow for this kind of information to be collected indiscriminately, accessed for criminal investigations across the board. And the European courts eventually said, no, You can't do that. You can't have mass surveillance of the whole population, except in these very, very narrow state security grants.
And this, who is responsible? I mean, and I presume this is why an action might be taken to get these questions out into the public domain. But who is responsible for asking these questions of the minister? I mean, who is above her? I mean, we might get some calls from the opposition. I don't know. They haven't perhaps decided which way the wind's blowing on this yet. But, you know, who can hold outside of the court system can hold the minister to account in this move to say, look, there are some basic questions that we require answers to?
Again, I think that's a really good question. And the short answer is nobody. So in other jurisdictions, in the UK and Amsterdam, for example, you have very strong oversight for surveillance. In the UK, you've got the Intelligence and Security Committee of the Westminster Parliament, which can look at the security services in detail, assess what they're doing. You've got a special type of court, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, that can look at surveillance and ask, is it legal? And it can do this in secret to avoid disclosure of confidential information. Similar type of setup in other jurisdictions like the Netherlands, where even an independent body that does all of these things. We don't have anything comparable in Ireland. The intelligence function isn't responsible to the Oireachtas. There's no Oireachtas committee that deals with this. The police, the policing authority doesn't have any function in relation to this. So state security measures are explicitly outside its remit. So the guards answer to the minister, and the minister essentially answers to no one.
Well, like, just to be clear, and I said this earlier on, TJ, I don't withhold any of my data, you know, on Google or Facebook or anything. I genuinely don't, because it's not something I'm particularly concerned about. But I am concerned about process. That's a personal decision to me, and it doesn't mean that everyone feels the same. I think, though, who is this judge? How was this judge chosen? What did they consider? Were they just signing off on what the minister said? Did they have anything to consider that opposed what the minister was proposing to them? Were they given an example of this threat that there is to this country? Very basic questions that I think require answers for any level of transparency in a democracy.
I think you're absolutely right. And I've heard informally that this took place in roughly an hour and a half, or just over an hour and a half worth of a hearing. Now, there are drunk driving cases which take longer than that to determine, never mind something of such gravity for the entire population. Mm. So I think it's very unsatisfactory. It's kind of giving, if you like, a veneer of a court procedure and the legitimacy we give to courts onto a procedure which doesn't look anything like a traditional court procedure.
I know for a fact, and this is not a slight against any particular individual or whatever, but both at a national and European level, Fine Gael representatives have been briefed to talk about cyber threats. And we saw that in the recent meetings that were hosted. Cyber security was a big push on. Is this related to that? Because I would have thought in terms of our cyber security, it would be external threats. But clearly it seems that the government believes that we're all a threat, or there's some sort of an internal threat. It's all sort of from the same parlance, the same sort of conversation. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist or right wing or anything like that. Don't get me wrong. But I can't help but noticing that there seems to be some sort of a direction of traffic here, the destination to which I have yet to work out.
Well, one problem with Irish law is historically it's never actually defined what's meant by national security or state security. So you have this very vague power, and it can be exercised then on foot of this, in turn, very vague purpose. So, no, we don't know. I think there's a case for saying, yes, cybersecurity issues and the kind of threats you see with, let's say, the HSE attack, the HSE ransomware attack, should be regarded as state security measures. But the short answer is we simply don't know, because the legislation doesn't say.
Yeah, and just so people are aware, with access to it, it's really quite limited data, but the way it's compiled, and I think you said it right at the very beginning, TJ, this gives very, very specific information about the activities and movements of anyone who has a phone. It's remarkable how accurate it can be in terms of pinpointing where you are, and of course all your communications can be stored. So what would be the nature of a challenge to this, TJ? I mean, are you going to progress that as chair of the Digital Rights Ireland, and what form might it take, and how quickly might it move?
I think it's very likely we will bring a challenge. We've brought a challenge before to this type of legislation. We succeeded. in the European Court of Justice in 2014, getting essentially the precursor to this struck down as contrary to EU law. Now, how long it'll take us to bring a challenge is another matter. Unlike the Minister for Justice, we don't have access to endless amounts of taxpayers' money to waste on defending these measures. We're dependent on donations. That said, hopefully we'll be in a position to bring a challenge within a year or so, if not sooner.
Yeah, and I just thought an interesting commentary from James Lawless, who's the chair of the Justice Committee. He said he agreed with the minister's move and said Ireland cannot be naive about national security threats. Well, in the absence of any information, is that naivety or ignorance? We simply don't know. And he said it's not incredible or implausible that here that there would be a national security concerns, but share those concerns with us. I mean, that's very strong language, national security concerns. I think the public are big enough to be able to process whatever the minister might know. But give us some context. Even give us one example, not you, TJ, but what a national security concern might look like.
I think that's an absolutely fair point. And maybe add to that, if it's a special and limited national security concern, if it's a specific threat, which is what's required under European law, how are we going to know when it's over? Or is this simply going to be an annual assertion? The state has national security issues, therefore this should continue indefinitely into the future.
Well, some might feel the national security threat is someone having access to all of our personal detail for a year, at least on an individual basis. And as you say, that's likely to be a rolling one-year situation. All right, TJ, listen, we'll see how things unfold. As I say, I don't think any of the questions or points I'm making or you're making are anti-anything. I think it's just literally saying, you know, this could be of some concern. What are we talking about here? You know, these aren't bold or rebellious questions. It's just give us some info.
I think you're absolutely right. Ultimately, the state attitude of, you know, we know better and you, the public, just have to accept what we say isn't really going to wash with the population.
No, I don't think the Irish are prepared to be treated as mushrooms any longer. Okay, thank you, TJ. TJ McIntyre, Chair of Digital Rights Ireland. As I say, I'm not the model of this program or programs like this should be. Well, what are you talking about? What does this mean? That's what we're trying to get to the bottom of. We probably, most of us, more than happy to support this move if we have some understanding as to why it took place, why it was, who is the judge, how was the judge selected, why was it in camera, what did the judge consider, what opposing views or counter arguments, if any, are required, were put there, what is this threat? Like, I don't think these are rebellious, unreasonable questions. I think that's sort of stuff that we are sort of kind of entitled to know. And a very good morning to you. How are you all getting on? Now, some of your comments here. So sad what's happening to people with gambling addiction. Ads for it on TV all the time and in the newspapers, like that lady says, free bets to lure you in. And the ads feature on radio and on this radio station as well, just for absolute transparency. That's they're booked through an agency. That's just the way it is. Greg, there is an ad on radio and TV for the National Lottery saying that one can buy up to 12 months of the lottery. Is this serious too? Yes, indeed it is. You can schedule it. Right, okay, next couple here. Greg, major problem at the moment is underage drinking. Local supermarket shops selling alcohol and vapes to underage with no thought or care. Person recently witnessed a boy roughly aged 13 buying vodka, several bottles at 3 p.m. in a big local shop chain store and wasn't questioned. Absolutely unacceptable. Needs to be a clampdown on this, and parental attitude is too accepting of kids drinking. And indeed, there was a recent study that shows exactly what you've just said, that we are becoming more tolerant of younger people drinking. All right, okay, let's go to Mark O'Donnell, a singer from beautiful Glenties. Mark, how are you getting on?
Hi, Greg, how are you?
I am doing good, congratulations. Your version... No, it's our pleasure, my word. It's great, we're celebrating a great Donegal success all this week, and just because there's so much of it. Right, you have a cover of The Real Things, You to Me Are Everything, and it featured on Love Island. It's a massive TV show on ITV2 on Monday. Congratulations. How did that come about?
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been a whirlwind of a few days. So I got word on Monday night at 8:20 that my song was going to feature in that night's episode. So the panic was on, trying to get myself organized to watch it, because I had been following the show because I had sent emails back in January to the winter series of the show, to try and see, just to kind of chance my arm at trying to get the song on the show. And I didn't have any success back in January, so I kind of said, you know what, look, it's, we'll call it a day, we'll try again maybe in a few weeks for the summer series. And so I sent a few emails just trying again, and just luckily I got word back from some of the producers, and then that was, it all kind of started from there.
And was it just that one track you sent, or have you sent numerous tracks, and do you sort of, were you kind of in the selection process saying, look, I know how the show works, I know when they do cutaways and stuff, you know, you tailored your product really to what they might use?
Yeah, so something I love doing is kind of taking, you know, those type of upbeat kind of songs and kind of maybe stripping them back a little bit and kind of putting my own twist on them, and maybe just kind of stripping it back to either just guitar or just piano. So you can kind of actually get a proper feel to the lyrics and that kind of thing. So I did that with two songs that I've released. I released my own version of Love Really Hurts Without You by Billy Ocean back in January. And I really loved that song, so I just thought I might as well get it out there. And then I decided then that I would record a second one. So I recorded a cover of myself singing it just on my phone. That's You To Me Are Everything. That was back in April, I think, early April. And I uploaded it to TikTok and it got 901,000 views.
Is that it?
Yeah, just that's it, yeah. But yeah, no, that was amazing. I was so taken aback by that. So just due to popular demand and the comment section and that, people asking me to get it released, I just decided, you know what, I might as well get it recorded professionally by my mate Paddy Malloy. He's from Glenties as well. So I decided I might as well record it, and I released it, and thankfully it's gotten a great reception. And then I decided then I might as well send the two songs into the Love Island team or the ITV production team to see if I could chance my arm again and just try again. And they got back to me, and so they have the two songs and their bank of songs on for the show that they use.
So we can imagine, right, that they turn around the shows really quickly. They're putting the shows together in production. It's based on what happened the day before, you know, and they go, right, okay, this You To Me or Everything's going to fit in perfectly here. So your other one's also on hold, so we probably could at some point then expect that to get some airplay before the season's out, because it's going to fit in to one of the scenarios on the show at some point.
Yes, of course. So basically they told me that they couldn't guarantee that they'd use either of the songs, and I had kind of accepted that. I was like, I'm so happy to even get this far that they've even considered my tracks. When they told me that they were going to use You To Me or Everything that night on Monday night, I was ecstatic. I was so amazed.
It's like, fantastic, and they must love it, because of course in advance they have to clear the rights and stuff as well, so they've obviously pre-approved it.
There was a few steps in the process first to just make sure everything was in order, just that it could be suitable for or was suited to TV and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you never know, they might use Love Really Hurts Without You in an episode to come, but to be honest, I'm just over the moon with what's happened already. So if something else happens in terms of Love Really Hurts Without You, if a scene, appropriate scene comes up that they will use it, I'd be absolutely delighted.
They even made a video for you.
I know, yeah, it's like my own personal music video.
Exactly, that saved you a fortune. And listen, this is not about becoming a millionaire overnight or anything. This is about exposure. And that's clearly something that you're all over, because you've got that relationship with your social media audience, and you know what they want, what goes viral. This is the next step here. This is to say, hold on, a song I recorded here has been featured on, you know, one of the most popular, if not the popular show in certain age demographics on British TV and Irish TV. So that is huge exposure for you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I was just amazed at the fact that they used it in that particular scene, and it was such a lengthy scene. And usually the songs are kind of used in the background and like maybe like a scene transition, that type of thing. But it was like the main song of that day.
What a buzz.
Tyreek and Ella, which was amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I have a few plans now to get my own original stuff recorded now in the future.
Because it's about capitalizing on this now, Mark. Yeah. I mean, this is a massive catapult forward. But you have to say, right, you've got to, you know, you have to make the most of this while the buzz is there, don't you?
Yeah, of course. So I've got a couple of more followers as a result of it, and I got added into the Love Island playlist on Spotify, which is huge. I'm delighted about that. So hopefully now the streams will go up a little bit with it as well. And yeah, I'm kind of looking forward now to the future and getting a few more projects in order, kind of recording some of my own original material. I love to write my own songs as well. So yeah, I'm going to be busy with that and balancing that and the teaching as well.
I
just recently qualified as a primary school teacher, so I'm starting a new job in September.
I mean this as a compliment? You look like you're in a school in fifth class.
Yeah, I am.
In fifth class. That's not because necessarily you look particularly young. It's just, you know, when you get really old or you start getting older, all of a sudden someone in their mid-20s looks 12. But anyway, listen, so what a year for you then. You've graduated, you're starting a new job in September, and you're getting songs featured on, as I say, in certain demographics, particularly amongst young people, the top show in Britain and Ireland. I mean, 2023, it's not going so bad so far. We're only halfway through.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just overwhelmed with all the support that I've been given or that I've got so far. And yeah, it's just, I'm kind of speechless the last few days. It just doesn't really feel real.
Brilliant. You know? Well, it is. And we're going to listen to your version of You to Me or Everything. Thanks so much, Mark. Continued success. And we'd love to have you in studio at some point, maybe over the summer before you start your new job and sing a couple of tracks for us, maybe one of these and one of your own, if you'd be up for that.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye. That's Mark O'Donnell. In fact, we're going to be out and about a wee bit over the summer, maybe down that direction. Maybe you might come over, maybe on the Friday of the Mary from Dunlow show, maybe. It'd be a nice, not too far for him to travel. I think that'd be a nice little gig if it suited him. Anyway, off air, we'll talk to Mark about that. So shall we hear this song that, as I say, reached a massive audience across Britain and Ireland and beyond? This is his version of You to Me Are Everything. It's originally from The Real Thing. This is Glenty's Mark O'Donnell.
Take the stars out of the sky for you. Stop the rain from falling if you ask me to. I'd do anything for you. Your wish is my command. I could move a mountain when your hand is in my hand. Words cannot express how much you mean to me. There must be some other way to make you see. If it takes my heart and soul, you know I'd pay the price. Everything that I possess, I gladly sacrifice. You to me are everything, the sweetest song that I can sing, oh baby. To you, I guess I'm just a clown who picks you up each time you're down, oh baby. Just a taste of love to build my hopes upon. You know you've got the power, girl, to keep me holding on. So now you've got the best of me. Come on and take the rest of me, oh baby. Though you're close to me, we seem so far apart. Maybe given time, we'd have a change of heart. If it takes forever, girl, then I'm prepared to wait. The day you give your love to me won't be a day too late. So you to me are everything, the sweetest song that I can sing, oh baby. To you, I guess I'm just a clown who picks you up each time you're down, oh baby. Oh baby, oh. Just a taste of love to build my hopes upon. You know you've got the power, girl, to keep me holding on. So now you've got the best of me. Come on and take the rest of me, oh baby. Oh baby. I would take the stars out of the sky for you. Stop the rain from falling if you ask me to. I'd do anything for you, your wish is my command. I can move a mountain when your hand is in my hand.
Okay, so we got a text in from a listener saying, "Hi Greg and team, I wonder would it be possible to discuss the cruise ships coming to Donegal? As far as I'm aware, when the ships dock at Killybegs, the local shops and businesses benefit from it. But when they come ashore at Greencastle, the town is full with buses and taxis whisking the passengers away to Derry and Antrim and beyond. They say not one passenger that I know of actually spends time in Greencastle or Mayville or anywhere else in the peninsula or Donegal. It's a real shame that local businesses cannot benefit from this massive arrival of tourists. Can there be any way to share the wealth? I won't, oh, don't begrudge anyone benefiting from tourism trade, but the landing spot losing seems unfair." Right, okay. So I get, no, we're not here to stir up anything. It's just to get some answers to questions like that, because there's always an answer. And Anna's going to help us with this one. Anna's one of the tour guides on those trips yesterday. So I suppose, Anna, first and foremost, as an island, it's great, and particularly as in the region, Northwest as a region, it's great to see us being included for stopovers and to you know, because hopefully these people come back and visit in a different way down the line, Anna. It's huge for the area.
Yes, it is huge, but I have had this said to me on a number of occasions too, Greg. You know, they come in and they're bussed out. And first of all, I've been doing this for over 20 years, mm-hmm. and this is my experience. Now, I think perhaps the person that maybe phoned in or something was referring particularly maybe to Greencastle. And maybe not, but perhaps. So it's not true to say that nobody benefits by this. First of all, you have a fleet of buses, 10, 15, 20 buses. All those buses, companies are being paid for that. There's drivers on those buses, and there's guides on those buses. So there's three things in particular that costs a lot of money. If they book into various venues, you know, which they do, those venues have to be paid. For instance, you take the Famine Village, for instance. Take the Famine Village in Donegal, which is one of the Greencastle routes. I'm just talking now about the Greencastle ones, not the others. I'll talk in a minute or two about Killybegs as well, which I have done over the years. And you have Glenveagh, you have the Folk Park, you have various places that they book into. So those things have to be all paid for as well. So it's not true to say that nobody is benefiting from it. With regard to the shops, now say for instance, which is a small fishing village, lovely little village, they can't dock there, obviously they're launched in from there. Now can you imagine 300 people, for instance, take for instance, there are about 10, 12, 13, 14 buses, and they're about, I had 42 yesterday, but that's another story. And can you imagine all those people that are going on those buses arriving in Greencastle Village? What are they going to do? Some of them, of course, they're always interested in history. There isn't any shops for a start off in Greencastle except one little shop. The same applies to Mobile. There are no shops in Mobile. There are certainly restaurants. There might be an odd grocery shop and that.
Am I correct in saying, too, that when you go on a cruise, when you disembark for the day trips, you choose whether or not you're going to go? So those landing in Greencastle would have been told, right, today, and I'm just giving examples, we've got a trip to the internationally recognised Ulster Folk Park, or we've got a trip to Glenveagh, and then people decide whether or not that might be of an interest to them. Perhaps how many would disembark if we were to say, well, we've got a couple of two beautiful villages, not an awful lot maybe there, but you can amble around them. How many would disembark? That's probably part of it as well, is it?
That is certainly part of it. And the other part of it is that even in a town, and I'll talk later about Donegal Town, even if there are shops, people do not buy things. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I have yet to see one individual coming on to my coach with a bag full of anything. And I mean that because the reason for that is that people who are on cruise ships, first of all, most of them are elderly people, retired people who are just out to enjoy the cruise and to enjoy the history. They have shops on board. They don't need to go into shops to shop. They can get all the little trinkets that they need or souvenirs on board the ship.
Now,
and they don't have to carry them around with them.
In the Keeley
but
Begs experience...
they're always very interested in the history of the place.
Now, if they get off at Keeley Begs, obviously, we've got the highest sea cliffs in Europe. There's Donegal Town. There's the castle. There's the Four Masters Monument. Even maybe if it coincides, there's the water bus, or maybe they just might think Donegal Town's a nice little quaint place to visit for pictures. Is it less of a challenge bringing them locally out of Keeley Begs than it might be out of Greencastle, then, is the question?
How do you mean less challenging?
Well, in other words, you've the stuff to do locally.
Well, I'll tell you what, when you go into... I have done Keeley Begs as well for a number of years. They go into Donegal Town, and yes, you're right, their interest is in history and the way of life here, the cost of houses, what's growing in the fields, the peat, the bog, the education system, what is the employment rate, and what do people work at. And one particular thing, an amusing thing, is usually because you have got people who have never seen a field of sheep in their life. They're out of cities somewhere. And they remark about what's grown in the fields, and they remark about the sheep and the colours. You know how the colours are on sheep for various reasons.
Why is that?
And I always have a bit of an amusing story with regard to that.
Well, Anna, just... with regard to
the colours on the sheep.
Yes, I can imagine. I only have a very short amount of time then, but I want to put it to you then. Do we need to be then saying, right, what can we, in a coordinated way... develop in Ashone for this market then? Is that a piece of work that could be done?
We have so much. We have what the people want. We have the scenery. We have the history. And particularly, you know, yesterday my tour was into the city of Derry, and we went to Eskeheen View. They love to see the views of the city. We took them to the murals. They want the story of the murals and the troubles in Derry. We took them to the museum where they were told about the Spanish Armada. And we just took them for a little stroll around. They just love the history. They're not out on a shopping spree.
Understood.
But there are so many people who do gain from these things.
I get you.
Such as the museums. And I could go on, I could be here for...
Well, it depends whether you want to... I think it's the Northwest economy. Maybe we have to look at this then rather than a village or a town. Anna, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. And hopefully that addresses some of the current concerns from that listener. Okay, the RTE executive faced 4 or 5 hours of stern questioning yesterday in front of an Oireachtas committee. They face another grilling a little later on today. Amongst those asking questions was Labour spokesperson on arts, media and workers' rights, Senator Marie Sherlock, who's been on the show before, of course, again, and we joins us now. Marie, how are you getting on?
Good morning, Greg. Good morning to all your listeners.
Good to have you on board with us. How do you rate the executive's performance yesterday?
Well, I think there was enormous frustration yesterday. There was obviously a huge degree of expectation that we would be somewhat clearer as to what exactly has happened in RTE. And I suppose the reality is that there are still so many questions outstanding with regards to culture, with regards to decision-making, with regards to accountability within RTE. And I think there was, you know, I posed a number of questions to the Chief Financial Officer, to the Head of Commercial. And frankly, the answers back about people not having a paper trail of unusual transactions, accounts of senior management effectively not communicating with each other about extraordinary circumstances, is frankly not good enough. I think it was quite telling that the chair, when I asked her about whether she presided over a dysfunctional executive, effectively confirmed that, yes, she is. And that's
but they also confirmed that in the process of answering questions, in that with everything that's gone on, with how negotiations are carried out, it was confirmed that the chief executive nor the acting director general or the acting director general knew if Patrick Kilty had actually signed a contract. Both of them had to go, well, we don't know, I don't know that, and then it was the chief financial officer that says, oh, yes, we do. Which demonstrated that this remains a dysfunctional executive where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. That unfolded directly before our eyes.
And that was a really remarkable moment yesterday where people had to look to each other to try and get answers. And I suppose, look, you know, the reality here is that we have got, you know, the national broadcaster, 1,800 people, the vast majority of whom go in, day out in the public service, like many of the independent radio stations like yourselves, to provide that service to people. And yet we have, unfortunately and very sadly, people at the top of the organisation at sixes and sevens with regards to their role. Like, and as I say, there are very clear questions now with regards to culture, with regards to accountability. And, you know, after the...
Can you have faith in that executive... Sorry, Marie, just to move it on a little bit, if you don't mind. Can you have faith in that executive in that...
Well, that's what I was going to say, Greg. Yes. And so we actually issued a statement last night on foot of the 4.5 hours hearing yesterday to say that there needs to be very serious reform now of the executive in RTE. And I think certainly Shuni Rahalig admitted yesterday that or acknowledged that there does need to be dramatic reform in order to reinstill confidence in the national broadcaster. Because the reality is that if we are serious about public service broadcasting in this country, if we do not want to go down the road of having a toxic situation like we have in Britain, or indeed in particularly in the United States, where there isn't that same sense of public service broadcasting, then we need to see investment in RTE. And of course, that has an impact right across the broadcasting sector.
But the thing is, at the moment,
the conditions are not right for that within RTE.
Yes, but that executive doesn't seem competent enough to steer that ship. That's my point to you. It's not only has it proven to be dysfunctional, but I think yesterday it proved they're incompetent on the basics. Like, there was one, like, the important questions were not answered in relation to who, what was the circumstances that we had these invoices being made out for consultative fees. If I'm not mistaken, Geraldine O'Leary was in on that. And of all the things that happened yesterday, the one lapse in memory was as it relates to that issue, as to why, who, or what led to these invoices being raised as consultative services. That was the only thing where there appeared to be a lapse of memory. One of the critical points of this entire process.
So there are many parts to this whole fiasco, Greg, that make very little sense. A, why there was an end of contract clause in Ryan Tubridy's contract for somebody who's there over 20 years, and to think that there was this additional thing put in, the guarantee that was given verbally by the then Director General, the effort to try and pay to make good that guarantee, which RT should never have given to the commercial to Ryan Tubridy and his agent, and then this sense of urgency that we learned of yesterday to try and sort out, you know, these fees and to channel through a barter account, which, you know, anybody listening to your show this morning who has any knowledge of how finance department works, no matter how small or how large an organization, you know, there are things that have to be channeled through the finance department. Yes, this was a barter account that stood outside the finance department, but there was efforts 2 years ago. So while some of these things were going on, to actually bring that barter account onto the balance sheet.
Also,
it seems to be the case that the financial officer, you know, there was he admitted as such yesterday that there was information, I suppose it might have been rumour or whatever it was, about these unusual transactions last year. But action was only taken in March of this year.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. I want to get to that timeline. There's three issues that I want to cram in the last few moments that we have. What concerned me most, and it went unchallenged, is the acting director general justified the current high rates of pay for the top talent, in inverted commas, which is a phrase I'm not terribly comfortable with. He said that it was based on what they believed that they could get paid in Britain or North America. Now, that to me is, when you have the acting attorney general, no, that's escaping me. I'll get back
director
to that in a second.
General.
Director general. When you've got the acting director general stating, justifying those wages, not saying they're going to come down necessarily in the future. He justified them because he believes that that is the type of money they could command internationally. Let me, and again, no one picked him up on this. Ryan Tubridy, who I have no issue whatsoever with, was unsuccessful in trying to break into Britain as a stand-in for Graham Norton on BBC Radio 4. He did it for one summer, was never invited back. That, if that is the what the acting director general believes is the justification for these big wages, if he believes that and he's in that position, that for me is a very, very serious concern.
So I think, Greg, I think there's a few things there. Firstly, the acting director general will be no longer in that role as of next month.
But it's cultural.
And Hathurst is due to assume that role. I asked the question directly of Shuni Rahalik, the chair, yesterday about the business model in RTE, because it's important to understand that there are many people on very, very modest or indeed very low incomes in RT who come in as contractors, come in as freelancers, or on fixed term contracts. And in order to be made a permanent employee, they have to go through a really arduous process, right? Called the contract review group. And yet on the other side, we have this opaque process whereby fees are negotiated via agents. And the reality is that very high fees have been justified on the basis that the persons could be poached by the BBC or elsewhere. Yet none of that has played out over the last 30 years. There's been only two defections, high profile defections from RT since the advent of Century Radio. And that's 30 years ago now. And Shuni Rahalik said something really telling yesterday. She said she had concerns about that. She said oftentimes RT was bidding against
itself. I thought that was important. And but
she said that she's had conversations with the incoming Director General, Kevin Backhurst, with regards to the relationship with agents and indeed how fees are set. So I think the key thing here from all this,
I get you, but if you don't
have this conversation, but in order, well, we need to have it so that we have a stronger RTE
All right.
At the end of it all.
Again,
and a fairer one.
Again, should this executive be in place, not only did they accept the resignation of Dee Forbes, precluding her from being compelled to go into the Oireachtas and answer questions, they asked for her resignation. That was accepted. No one on that executive said, right, if we accept this resignation now, it precludes her being compelled before that. Also, there is statutory notice, I believe, in this country, dependent on the amount of time you service, that you have to give notice of your resignation. Was that waived? Who waived it? It stinks like a cover-up, Marie, and I think that requires far more scrutiny and accountability, because they've robbed the Irish people of access to the one person or one of a two or three people that can answer these questions. So you've got another person who's there going, I don't remember. And the person that could answer these questions, the executive themselves, by accident or design, have construed a scenario where we can't ask Dee Forbes these questions. That is a sackable offence, in my view.
So I think, Greg, first thing is that Dee Forbes has issued a medical letter, or her doctors have issued a medical letter to the committee, and she is out sick at the moment. And I think, you know, there needs to be respect, and we need to be very careful about demanding that she's in front of a committee.
Go back a week.
Sorry, Greg, let me finish the point, right? Because there's three points you've made there. So number one, she's out sick at the moment. She absolutely has to answer questions. And I've been saying this on the record all week, both Dee Forbes, but also previous director generals, because this isn't just this fiasco does not just cover her time as director general, but also the previous director general, Noel Curran, as well. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of the resignation, I think there are very serious issues now about when we actually learned yesterday at a very late stage of the committee that actually her resignation had been sought much earlier than any of us knew or assumed. And I think in terms of your point about notice period, now the employment lawyers can correct us on this, but, you know, yes, there are notice periods, but an employer can waive a notice
period. Exactly, that's my point. Yeah, that's my point. Who waived it and why did they waive it?
The Director General is reportable to
her departure from RTE was fast-tracked.
Pardon?
Her departure was fast-tracked.
Well, look, I think the thing is, going back to the point I've just made there, it is absolutely vital that she does provide a comprehensive account. Because, look, okay. She's not compelled to anymore.
That's my point, Marie.
She has rejected RTE's account. Like, as in, there was a statement issued at the start of this week where she, you know, effectively has said that, you know, what RTE has previously said at the end of last week is not correct.
Okay, and finally, do you not think it quite interesting that the acting director general changed his position on Ryan Tubridy's contractual status during the course of that hearing? Do you not think that's really quite interesting?
Well, Greg, I'm still unclear as to what Ryan Tubridy's contractual
He's currently contracted, he's currently paid, and the acting director general corrected himself and said towards the end of the hearing that he still has a radio contract. Earlier in the hearing, he said he has no contract, that the radio contract had terminated with the TV contract and he's currently out of contract because the negotiations have been paused. He changed his testimony to that committee midway through it.
Yeah, no, and that's why I'm saying I think we're all still confused. And Ryan Tubridy, you know, it is reported that there was a statement from him yesterday. I have not seen that yet, that he rejects, it was certainly reported in one of the main newspapers, that he rejects what RT is saying about his contractual status. So I don't believe that and I think this will be one of the questions for the Public Accounts Committee today, to get absolute clarity on where his contractual, what his contractual status is. And I think, as you referred to at the start of this piece, you know, there was confusion yesterday about the status of Patrick Kielty's contractual situation with RTE. So I think that in itself is telling. Mm. But I think, Greg, what's really, really important here is that this is a crisis that's going to keep on giving and giving. Like, I asked a question yesterday about whether there are those outside of the top 10 who are in receipt of top-ups or side deals. Now, I asked each of those attending the hearing yesterday. They all said no. But I think we need to be very clear about that, right? And I think there's still so many questions. And ultimately, in order for this crisis to move on, in order for the public to have, I suppose, to renew that confidence in the national broadcaster, we need to see very significant change at the top of RTE.
All right. And listen, I think we need a national broadcaster. Well, I don't think it. I think that's what a lot of people think. I think also we need to look at the other elements of what we fund, i.e. the likes of, and I've said it before in this programme, 2FM, etc., whereby it doesn't serve, there is no public service element to that. It's actually a competitive advantage to the independent sector. You know, we could start saving money that way. Yes, you probably need your RTE1s, but I mean, in terms of paying for Network 2 to do reruns of Dr. Phil and also, you know, paying for a rival to independent commercial stations in the likes of 2FM, personally, I don't see where the public is served in that. But anyway, that's Marie. Thanks.
Well, we need a vibrant broadcasting sector. I think this is the thing, you know, and I think both independent and public broadcaster need to be supported. Like, that's ultimately the crux of really what we need to aim towards here. But getting the house in order in RT, you know, has to be done first, because I think all those issues about future investment are unfortunately put on hold now because of the debacle that we're currently experiencing.
Lovely to have you on the show as always, Marie. Take care of yourself. All right, bye-bye. That's Senator Marie Sherlock there. Right, now, Ella Doherty is the winner of our tickets to the Elemental premiere. You're going to a premiere, Ella. You're going to take your three sisters and you'd love the day out. And you're in Mayville. We've picked you. And the 60s, we're going to put six tickets together for you to choose who's going with you. All right, well done, Ella Doherty from Mayville. You won that. Okay, see you tomorrow, Friday. All the usual stuff. Looking forward to it already. Bye-bye.